Kia ora tātou. Good morning, everybody. I hope everybody enjoyed the dinner last night and you got a good night's sleep ready for the last day of the conference. I'm Penny Hawkins, for those of you that don't know me. I'm from New Zealand and I work at NZAID. It's my pleasure this morning to introduce our last speaker, Dr. Phil Davis. Phil is Executive Director of Oxford Evidentia, which was formerly AIR UK, the UK subsidiary of the American Institutes for Research in Washington, DC. From 2000 to 2006, Dr. Davis was Deputy Director of the Government School Research Unit in the UK Cabinet Office, and later in Her Majesty's Treasury. Prior to joining the Cabinet Office in 2000, Dr. Davis was a university lecturer at Oxford University and director of the Social and Political Sciences in the Department for Continuing Education at Oxford. He's held other academic appointments in the UK and the USA. And he also told me last night that he likes mountain walking. And I thought afterwards I should have suggested that he tried to scale the heights of Capitol Hill and even walk over Parliament, which I think this is probably the only capital city in the world where that's possible. But you might meet a few armed guards, so perhaps not a good suggestion. Anyway, I'll hand over to Phil Davis now. Thank you.
Thank you, Penny. Don't listen to people at dinners. I don't been on a mountain in my life. that's not true. Well, first of all, thank you for having me and for the very kind invitation to come and share the best part of a week with you all and to already learn a great deal about evaluation that I should have known already. So it's been a great learning experience for me. I do appreciate having been invited by the organizing committee. And also let me just say a special thank you to the AES administrative people and to Conference Solutions. They've, you know, bringing somebody from quite a long way away has all sorts of logistical detail and they've done it absolutely brilliantly. I'm here in one piece. This is very much a presentation along the lines of somebody who has been on both the supply and the demand side for evaluation, and in a sense, I guess, as Penny said, I was in the Cabinet Office and the Treasury for 6 years, where I played really an intermediary role, a classic sort of bridging role between us, the world of basically evaluation providers, and research providers, and a government that had come in 1997 committed to evidence-based policy. Clearly, when we look back on it, it was a rhetorical device to get through the 1997 election. And when they got into Downing Street, the Prime Minister was saying, well, what is this evidence-based policy? You know, and somebody told him it's doing what works. And if you hear any speeches of Tony Blair between 1997 and 2000, I don't think many were there without him saying, what matters is what works. So we then had to gear up an internal analysis division to do evidence-based policy. And I should explain, in Britain, we have a very large analytical capacity within government. We have 1,000 social researchers, of which I was the deputy director. We have about 700 or 800 economists, 400 or 500 statisticians, it varies, and about 200 operations analysts, which is an army of people to do analysis for government, in addition to which we spend about $175 million a year commissioning research and evaluation from outside contractors. So there's a lot going on, and when suddenly people had to pitch their work to the ideology, and I use the word advisedly, the ideology of evidence-based policy, there was an awful lot of capacity development, training, professional development, and an adaptation of what people already did to make it fit in with the policy process. So let me just rehearse. I'm sorry for the people who came to my workshop on whenever it was, Monday, that's right. You've heard the first bit of this, but go get a cup of coffee or something. Why do we want evidence-based policy? I think there's five main reasons. and there'll probably be six because I always think of another one. First is the effectiveness issue that we talked about quite a bit this week. It's making sure that in government, at all levels, right down to public service delivery agencies, that we are doing more good than harm. Sounds fairly self-evident, but when you look at a lot of, as we know, as evaluators, you look at a lot of the programs that are rolled out by government, a lot of the work that public services do, with the most well-intentioned, hard-working people you'll find, we often don't really know whether we do any good. And sometimes when we evaluate it, we find actually we're doing harm, either through unanticipated consequences or because we haven't attended to the detail of implementation and rollout and the specifics of how to do this. Second, equally important, is because we're all working with finite resources, indeed at the moment probably with declining real resources, we have to be efficient, which means we've got to get the maximum benefit from every pound or dollar or euro or whatever your currency is that you spend on public services and generally the public purse. Third, and this was something very close to the heart of Prime Minister Blair's message to the civil service, was that the civil service is a service organization. As he reminded us, we serve the people, not the other way around. It was a bit of a shock to the British civil service, that, which had grown up on an empire sort of mentality and really didn't attend to the fact that you are providing a service. And that means part of that service is knowing quite a lot about citizens' needs, their expectations, their demands, their wants, which are, of course, all very different things, and that they are changing over time. So, you know, you really do need a monitoring and an evaluation system built into the work of government if you want to meet those service requirements. Fourth, I think evidence-based policy is about accountability and transparency, particularly in terms of explaining what we're doing, but more importantly, I think, why we're doing it, and to really give the public the icing on the cake, maybe telling them if there's a hope in hell that we might be able to do it properly. We have a much more, well, we like to believe we have a much more intelligent electorate now. We've had 60 to 100 years of public education. We have 70% of people going to universities and higher education. People aren't prepared just to be told that the government's doing the right thing. You've got to justify what you're doing and given a good account for it. I think that's only good. It's only good also, my fifth point, I told you there'd be a sixth, is I think that's part of enhancing democracy. It is part of the democratic process to hold people to accountability, to be transparent, and also to be critical and thinking about what it is we're doing, both as citizens, but also as the provider of public policy and public services. Which goes to my last point, the sixth point, the one I'd forgotten, but is terribly important. I think that this is about helping to re-establish or to ensure trust. In the United Kingdom and many other countries of Europe, and certainly in the US and Canada, I don't know about Australia, we have plenty of routine evidence from rolling omnibus surveys that the trust in public institutions generally, but in politicians and even civil servants, has never been lower, and it's declining considerably. And I think part of that is because people often don't know what is being done in their name or why it's being done or whether it has any chance of meeting their needs and expectations. So that, if you like, is the high level, you know, the good reasons for, I think, having evidence-based policy. So what is it? Well, I really believe it's not that complex. It is, to me, it starts with some simple principles of helping people make better decisions at all levels. It could be at the Cabinet Office, it could be in the Prime Minister's office, it can be at the local hospital, the principal of a school, the administrator, the manager of a Job Centre Plus employment agency, or in the private sector, running an airline, which they don't seem to have quite worked out how to do, running a restaurant. Doesn't matter what you're doing, if you're making decisions, it's quite a good idea to be better informed along the lines that we've been talking about this week. And that goes to the point of helping us run better services, both public and private. It's most interesting that in the second term, I wasn't in the Cabinet Office for most of the first term, but the second term of the Labour government, we were all asked to be really efficient and effective, like for instance the banks. If we could just get ourselves running public services like we run the banks, we'd be all right. You don't hear that vernacular nowadays, that discourse. They were held up very much about the sort of super competitive, bottom line, high energy activities. And at the moment, there's a lot of head scratching going on about how you fix them. And a lot of that is to do about, you know, what does make a good bank? What is good banking? What are effective practices? If you have any solutions, number 10 Downing Street, London, SW1A2WH. We do this by using, first of all, existing evidence more effectively. This is something I do carp on about, but I feel quite passionately, is that often we don't immediately need to go and do new research or evaluation. We do need research and evaluation, don't get me wrong, but we really do have to harness what we already know. If we can do that, it may be that we either don't need more research and evaluation, or it'll be much more clear what it is we need, my second point, and what we need to procure, what we need to provide, and also to try and fill in something we've talked a lot about this week, the theory of change, the logic model that needs to be in place. And we can often learn a lot about that by simply seeing what has been done already, what is known already, and what isn't known about a particular problem or a particular intervention or a policy. So to me, that's its two elements. It's using what we already know and getting new evidence, new evaluation, new research in a very very efficient way. But it isn't just that. And one of the reasons why evaluation and research doesn't get into policy and practice is because we forget the next thing on the screen. We don't integrate this with some very important elements, and I'm going to go through them. Some of the key factors that in real politic have to be taken into consideration if you're trying to try to be effective and get evidence into policy and practice. So I'm making the argument that for me, evidence, I would love it to be at the heart of what governments do, what the heart of public and private servants do in the services they provide. A very rational model, I must admit, but the first thing we have to acknowledge is that evidence doesn't, nor will it ever, be the driver of policy. What drives policy and many practice scenarios and situations, many of the professions are driven not by evidence, but by belief, by values, by ideology. The professions are just as bad as government. Government does this quite explicitly because they have elections every 4 or 5 years, 3 here in Australia. But in the professions, in education, health, social work, crime and justice, international development, people don't often realize that they're doing things because they passionately believe in them, and that's it. Now, I have no objection to people doing things because they believe in things. It is important. It doesn't go away. But the model I'm trying to develop, if you see, just loops into evidence. It would be very nice if we can have an interaction between ideology, value, beliefs, and I do appreciate they're different, and some notion of evidence, whether that be quantitative, qualitative, the swamp of relativism, I like that, or the arrogance of absolutism, as we heard yesterday. It would be nice if it would engage with some notion of evidence. Secondly, both of those have to interact with the experience and the expertise of policymakers, with public servants, people who are managing public and private services. This is often knowledge and ability and competence that people have acquired over many years and should not be ignored. The idea that somehow the results of our interesting evaluation should trump people's experience, I think, is wrong. A lot of that's to do with people's tacit knowledge, what Michael Polanyi called tacit knowledge. It's the knowledge you don't always know how to make explicit, but it's the stuff you know about the how, the when, in what context. It's about being a professional. And you really got to, I think we need to understand that. And I'll mention later, we did a study in the Cabinet Office of senior civil servants to try and get into some of that tacit knowledge. It's very hard because it's tacit, but to try and reveal, as it were, the decision-making processes that go on in policymakers and providers' thinking. And also on that last point, their expertise. More and more now in the British civil service, we are encouraging people to stay within a brief, excuse me, for some time. It used to be the tradition you do 2 years in health, 2 years in education, you move on. That's probably good in the early years, but it's not a bad idea when you're running multi-billion pound services to have people who really do understand it from the inside out and have maybe a 10-year experience of health, international development, or whatever it is. Sorry, I'm going backwards. And then judgment. Judgment is also one of those imponderables. It's very hard to, as we know, as evaluators, it's very hard to explicate that and to measure it. But it is an important element about how we make policy. It's about using people to interpret and to bring judgment to evidence. I firmly believe that evidence rarely tells you what to do. It may suggest what to do, it gives you indicators, it gives you a good guide to where you might go, but you've got to judge what that evidence is, particularly in the light of the wider perspective, the bigger picture. We've heard quite a bit this week about joined-up government, wraparound government, which I see is now very popular here in Australia, which is all well and good, but if you don't know how to join that up, if you don't know about that wider picture, it's going to be very hard to do that. And that's another way in which evidence can interact with the policy-making process. And as I said a moment ago, it's not just about being effective, it's about being efficient. And therefore, we do have to consider resources. When our Prime Minister was going around the world telling people evidence-based policy is simply doing what works, I think that's only half the story and an incorrect representation. It's doing what works with what resources to achieve what outcomes, which is what sort of language we talk about. Very annoying to decision makers and to ministers, because although they know it, because they have to manage the resources. But it's a much more sophisticated issue about trying to achieve certain outcomes with certain resources, particularly when often the evidence that we provide for decision makers is either inconclusive or tells them that the effect of some initiative is going to be fairly marginal. So we have to consider that against resources, which is why we, of course, need to work with economists and people of that ilk. Another factor that affects the policy-making process is sheer tradition and habit. Bureaucracies have a sort of self-fulfilling way of working. When I went into the Cabinet Office, I'd never been a civil servant in my life, I used to ask people why we did things, all sorts of things, like the way we did briefings, the way particularly the way we did briefings, and the answer was always, oh, we've always done it that way. And I said, since when? About 1820. and they didn't mean 20 past six either, they meant the year 1820. So there is a sort of a habitual nature to bureaucracy, of all bureaucracy, not just the civil service, and that's that. Mentality is something you have to embrace. You have to change it as well, in my opinion. But if you don't work with that mentality for an institution like, for instance, the British Civil Service that's been around for zonks, you're not going to get your evidence into practice. Another element, which I know will be very active in Australia, is the role of lobbyists and pressure groups. I found them in my years in government to be immensely powerful and also very good. In fact, one of my take-home messages is we should start becoming like lobbyists and pressure groups. If we could learn some of the tricks, it's stunning to see how a lobbyist can make a case and have convinced a minister in 20 minutes, maybe an hour if they give them lunch, in a way that we just don't know how to do. Or maybe you know how to do in Australia, but in England we just don't. In Britain we don't. You know, we can take an age and still not get over to the first bullet point. So lobbyists are not just to be ridiculed because they are so good at what they do. Some of them also, I have to say, are very research-based, evaluation-based, and evidence-based. Others aren't, or if they are using evidence in a very selective use of evidence, to, of course, do what they're paid to do, is to make a case. And lastly, in this model, and there are many other factors, but these are ones that really were sort of day-to-day occurrences when you work in a central government department, is what I'm calling pragmatics and contingencies, and it could just be called, I'll put it politely, stuff happens, which can be anything like in 2002, we had severe flooding in England. That did make me laugh because we had an all-points bulletin to find out why we have floods in England. I thought it's fairly self-evident. It rains every day. But we spent a lot of money on that one, and indeed we are quite rightly now, there is a more serious issue. It is to do with climate change and the structure of the earth, and to do with the fact that our banks of our rivers are now wearing away, and we need, that there's a serious point to that. But something like that can suddenly, it has to be dealt with very quickly, because you've got people drowning, literally, and losing their houses. Or it could be something as grotesque as 9/11, which I was in the Cabinet Office during on 9/11 and during that period. That single event, and I go around the world talking to governments about evidence-based policy, every government has had to completely reorient its policy-making priorities in light of 9/11. The monies, I don't know about Australia in terms of cash terms, I can tell you in Britain, the monies that are now going into counter-terrorism and security that would have gone into health, education, social service is phenomenal. It's in the billions. And, of course, we're fighting two wars that are perhaps not fully thought through and are really, costing an awful lot of money. So things happen, and they have to be responded to. Now, the classic response to that is, we can't bother with evidence when things happen. You just go out and act. I think there's nothing more wrong than that. I think that's precisely when you need to stand back and say, well, hang on. What do we know? What don't we know? Who can help us with this in a very short time, rather than going off half-cocked, which is tends to be what happens, and having a solution, but a solution that either gets an immediate effect but then starts doing harm, or has a chain reaction effect that throws the whole policy-making process out of sync. Excuse me. So the take-home message there is, if we want to get evaluation evidence into practice and into policy, which we must do, is we've got to think of these other factors. And the point about the Olympic-style overlapping circles is that you have to, these things interact. This is an interactive model. And it requires us to be, these sort of the key points you have to think about in your own decision-making when you're using evidence in order to see how we can effectively get what we do so well to be used in practice. Now, we've talked a lot about effectiveness this week, and that's pretty much the heart of a lot of policy-making and the heart of a lot of evaluation. I think we have to clarify that there are different types of effectiveness, which goes to the whole question about the plurality of methods. There is what we talked about a little bit, I've talked about this morning, intervention effectiveness, the so-called what works question, and the resource effectiveness, just as important, which is the efficiency question, costs and benefits. A third type of effectiveness which we need to know, and we as evaluators usually provide, is what I call diversity of effectiveness. Who is this going to work for? Under what circumstances? In what parts of the country? Or is it not going to work for? What constitutes working for different parts of the population? These are the more interesting questions that we as evaluators ask. Our line always is, isn't it? The subgroup analysis is often more important and more interesting than the top, the headline message. But diversity of effectiveness is crucial if we're to make effective policy. And in light of that, produce effective services, which goes to the fourth type of effectiveness, which is implementation effectiveness. How is something supposed to work? Under what conditions does it work? What do you need in place for it to get to work? And that can be very variable within the same country. The idea that somehow we have a one-size-fits-all implementation model for a country, although as small as Britain, as diverse as Britain, with a 70 million population, it's just ridiculous. You're going to have very different types of implementation according to those circumstances. And then, last but not least, this is not a hierarchy, believe me. I should put it up front just to convince you. Is experiential effectiveness. It's that juxtaposition of the subjective experience of public policy and the objective presentation of it. We've heard a lot this week about people chasing targets, having objective, goal-oriented governments. One of the buzzwords and very important organizing principles of policymaking in a lot of European countries at the moment is performance-managed government, which can be very effective. But you often find that you've hit targets, you've achieved goals, you've done what you're supposed to have done, and yet when you ask the citizens If we have, they say, not at all. You know, we've hit most of the targets in the British National Health Service that were set in 2002 and again in 2005, because we have 2-year spending reviews. We hit the targets, but as somebody once said in a Department of Health meeting, we keep on hitting the targets but missing the point. And we miss the point because we're not really either attending to the targets that the populace want, or if we are, we're doing it in a way that they don't feel, they don't experience to be having hit the target or the point. So experiential effectiveness is crucial. Now that maps very nicely, I think, onto evaluation 1A, 101A, whichever you want to call it. The first, whenever you teach this in a university, what do? There's two types of evaluation. There's impact or a summative evaluation, which really goes largely to the does the policy, does the program, does the intervention work, does it not work, and so forth. Then the more process or formative evaluations that, again, we've talked about a lot this week. You know, how, why, under what conditions does the policy or the program work or not work? And I don't know why we make them quite distinct, because to me they're part and parcel of the same question. I personally don't know how you get an impact, a true impact that will be a real world impact, unless you have the process or the formative evaluation interweave between it. Back to the issue of the week about random allocation trials, randomized control trials, whatever you want to call them. I don't know how you can do them unless you have done an awful lot of qualitative work in the preparation for them, unless you've built in outcome measures that have got external as well as internal validity, that really mean things to people who are going to be affected by the policies. And the workshop we had on Monday, we looked very closely at a piece of policy that I was responsible for, where we spent the best part of a year designing both a policy and also its evaluation, which was for a randomized control trial. That we had to do it, we were told by Treasury, it had to be a randomized control trial. But we spent most of the year not planning the trial was the easy bit. You know, that wasn't rocket science. It was preparing the ground to get the things that go into the trial and the outcomes we had to measure correct and, as I say, ecologically valid. So now I want to take us through the types of evaluation evidence that, and what I'm going to do here, this is how we have started training our evaluators and researchers in government. And in fact, a lot of the contractors who work for us we run a training professional development course in the Cabinet Office, actually just been transferred to Treasury, but it's a government training course. And we do it by thinking of the different questions that they as analysts, they as evaluators should be asking as we go through the policy process. A bit like Cheryl Gray yesterday, I may be telling grandmothers to suck eggs, but please, tolerate me for a moment. First of all, it is our job to play the critical friend, to do the challenge function, and to say to policymakers, how is this policy supposed to work? The white boxes are the questions that I think we should ask. How is this policy supposed to work? This is the thinking through the things through question, which of course goes to our theory of change, our program logic, our logic model. We can use various terms for this. But unpacking, usually in a sequential way, what has to take place in what sequence of events for inputs to become throughputs, to become outputs, to become outcomes. We know that this is what we do. We've heard about it all week. You're very skilled at doing it. But it shouldn't be us that does. We've really got the policymakers to do this with us. If you don't build it into the policymaking process, they'll ignore it. It's really changing the way you do policymaking. And fortunately, we've really started to find some real gains in the art and the science of policymaking by getting not just us to do it, but to do it with policymakers and to have it part of their modus operandi. So that's the first sort of chunk of things that we really have to think about as we begin to build policy in a policy world. Second is, it's the analyst's job to really say, what do we already know about this? Back to what I was saying earlier about using existing evidence effectively. Harnessing existing evidence, which is why we do research synthesis, which is now a very interesting family of things that we do. It used to be the literature review. Well, we've long since passed from that. We then went to systematic reviews or narrative systematic reviews. We've had vote counting reviews, about which I can't say much today, but I'd avoid them like the plague. We have statistical meta-analysis, which are very helpful, but again, they're all sort of pitfalls for people who don't understand how to do them and often get it wrong. We have evidence maps, which we are particularly, the group that I work with, we do a lot of evidence mapping. We do rapid evidence assessments. That's a systematic review, but that is timed very much for the policy-making timetable, often between just maybe 6 and 12 weeks, where we very much can't take the whole year or 2 years to do a full systematic review or a statistical meta-analysis, but we can certainly get into a great amount of the existing evidence, critically appraise it, and extract from that the key messages, and give a steer to our policymakers about what the evidence on balance is telling us. The reason why that's important is, and I put this challenge down and nobody's ever taken it up, I can probably find evidence for a policymaker or anybody in this room to do anything they want to do in public policy, okay? If you want to privatize schools, I can find you some evidence for that. If you want to close schools and have homeschooling, I can find you evidence for that. If you want to have it run as a Marxist state, I can probably find you evidence for that. Okay, it's very easy to find evidence out there. The question is how you get the balance of evidence and get that in a weighted way, in a way that really gives a clear and representative steer to decision makers. Next set of questions for the analyst, for the evaluator in government is usually, well, what is the nature of the problem? What is the size of the problem? What are the dynamics of it? Often we make policy in a knee-jerk way. We have just had yet again, I say yet again because for the last four decades we have had these terrible incidents of parents abusing their children and killing them. And we've had a celebrated case, the Baby P case, which yet again has laid bare the effectiveness of what we do in child protection. And social workers get it every which way. It's always their fault if it goes wrong, but if they go and do the things that are required to stop it going wrong, they're seen as interfering and being part of the nanny state. But first of all, if you start looking at that emotive problem, it isn't that large a problem, that doesn't negate it, but you need to know something about the nature of it, the size of it, what's driving it, in what circumstances do you get these terrible events. And that does require... It requires us to really do a more descriptive or an analytical or to gain analytical evidence of a more experiential nature. We need to use quite an array of tools here. We need to use surveys. We need to use qualitative research. We really do need to get inside the problem on this. And that is often something we don't do. We don't spend enough time really understanding the nature of the problem, its size and its dynamics. And then when you're pushed towards the effectiveness question, which usually crops up very quickly in a policy circle, in a policy team, the question is, well, what works? And that usually means, can you please find me evidence that it works in the way I want it to work? Our job isn't to do that. Our job is to look for proven effectiveness, preferably against the counterfactual in a number of ways, using experimental or quasi-experimental designs, about which we've heard an awful lot this week. And often you get to the point that we don't know. We either don't know because nobody's really evaluated this previously, or if they have done, they haven't done a great job of it, or more typically, the evidence is equivocal, particularly if you look at all the evidence from different evaluation studies. Or fourthly, the effect that the preferred policy or the policy under review is so marginal that it's very hard to justify it given the available resources. But I see that that's a very important question to ask. In which case, we have to think very seriously about doing an impact or a summative evaluation using some of the rather sophisticated models that we have now for establishing the counterfactual. Then, because we're working with that finite budget, we have to then ask the question, what is the cost of this program, this policy? What are the benefits? Which is the most effective way of doing it if you're looking at two or three policy options? And this is, of course, the stuff and trade of economists. People this week, by the way, have talked quite warmly, and I thank you for that, about using our magenta book. The magenta book is our riposte to the Treasury's green book. The green book, which is an extremely good guide for doing economic appraisal and cost-benefit study. It's as good in Australia as it would be in Britain. It's used across the world now. But the trouble with it, the reason why we wrote the magenta book, is the economists told us that's all you need to know. Just do an economic appraisal, cost-benefit analysis, or a cost-utility analysis, or a cost-effectiveness study, work out the premium rate, do some discounting, and you're home and dry. We know evaluation is to be much more complex than that, hence why we did the magenta book. But it is important that we do have good economic and econometric analysis in our evaluation base. And lastly, I haven't got time to go into this, but I think very important is what I call ethical evidence. Because in public policy, we are nearly always making trade-offs against different options. That isn't just a technocratic enterprise, which is where I think economists sometimes get it wrong. It is a technocratic enterprise, but it's more than that, because you're actually trading a whole set of values and ethical principles that affect different population groups. So if you're looking at child care services versus care of the elderly services, you're actually trading off quite different sets of values about how we value life, about life in the early years versus life in the latter years. And that can be a very complex set of circumstances, and it sets it's the background material against which our economic and our evaluative appraisals take place. So I think for those questions, what are the ethical questions we need to use the principles of social ethics? I learned so much working with clinical ethicists when I worked in health services, and they came and helped us do this in other areas of public policy, to really work through some of the ways that social ethicists work, which is really intriguing and very, very interesting. And that usually takes us to some notion of public consultation, because what we need to identify is not just what are policymakers' values, but what are our values? What are the societal values of early life versus later life? And all sorts of procedures have been tried for this. Those of you in the health sciences will probably know the Oregon method that was tried for many years, still is used in the state of Oregon, built very much around the town hall meeting, where they try to get some representative group of people to be in a town hall and to review the issues, the allocation issues that are of the day. In Britain, we've been using citizens' juries, which is very similar to a jury you would have in a court of law, but again, a representative panel of our peers, in which expert opinion and analytical opinion and policy perspectives are brought to them, and people are asked to consider the issues and the ethical issues, and to try and give a steer as to what are the social values and what are the priorities that we should be giving to different elements of policy. So, quite simple, really, when you think of it. It only dawned upon me the other day, because I've used this slide quite a bit. It was unintentionally, but it's so important that it is circular. There isn't a hierarchy in it. There is no verticality, if there is such a word. There is no one is greater than the other. The point is, it's driven by the questions that you're asking. And when you do it that way, then you find appropriateness, and that's where we can talk about quality, raising the bar, and all that sort of talk, because you want to be doing the best social ethicist analysis, the best descriptive analysis, the best ethnographic inquiry, to the highest quality standards. Okay, so just some problems, and then I'm going to try and leave some time for questions. Some challenges. First of all, the perennial, timeliness. Evaluation and policy timetables rarely synchronize, okay? Well, that's because we don't design them to synchronize, because we tend to work in a firefighting world. You can avoid that if you take a more strategic approach, both to policy and to evaluation. When I was in the Cabinet Office, I worked in the Prime Minister's Strategy Unit, which was totally new. Nobody had ever heard of a strategy unit. Now, all government departments have a strategy unit to do this type of work. Our mission, straight from the Prime Minister, was not to worry about Britain today. As he pointed out, there's 450,000 civil servants doing that with mixed efficacy. Your job, he said, is to think about Britain 2010, this was in 2002, Britain 2010, 2015, and 2020. And I was in the Cabinet Office the other day, they've now got the team 2025. They are looking at what Britain will look like, is likely to look like. This is future stuff. This is horizon scanning stuff. But it's difficult and must not lead to just speculative conjecture. It really is pushing the limits of how we use our analytical skills. What will the population look like? How many hospitals we need? How many schools we? What type of schools will we need? What will learning mean? Trying to anticipate what the policy issues are going to be like in 5, 10, and 15 years down the line, and then commissioning and procuring the evaluation now so that when we get to 2010, which is very close, 15 and 20, we're not scrabbling around like chickens with their heads cut off saying, anybody got any evidence, okay? We've proven this to work in quite a few of our strategic plans where we've done 2, 3, and 4 year evaluations that we started in 2002 that have come in now and we're ready to go. The policies are being rolled out and they're making much better policy. One exception to that, where we did a very large randomized control trial of a specific program, which on every variable we looked at showed that it didn't work and that it had precisely the opposite effect that the government intends. The bill was passed in November, it's gone through, they're pushing the policy through regardless of the fact that it hasn't got a hope in hell of working. So it doesn't always work because you're back to the political imperative. But if we can work strategically and together, that's having policymakers and evaluators working together, and I'll come back to that in a minute, then we have a better chance of avoiding the synchrony problem. And I've made the case, I think, for evaluating and using existing evidence, very important. Another problem is, let's be honest, a lot of evidence, evaluation and research evidence isn't up to scratch. It just doesn't pass muster. And we have to be honest about that. The great value of having the AES and having other evaluation societies is they have raised professional standards. They've first of all, defined professional standards and they have enforcement procedures, which has helped enormously. But if you do systematic reviews, which I do a lot, most of our time is struggling to find out how we can possibly keep a study in the corpus of material to review because it is either done so badly, or it's been reported badly, or it's just not fit for purpose. So we've got to be very self-reflective on that and say that sometimes you wouldn't want to take evaluation evidence into policy because it's just not up to scratch. The next problem is our work is often inaccessible to policymakers. Similarly in the form that it's complex doing what we do. We tend to need to have lots of graphs and tables and figures and usually 100, 200 pages of scribble, of words, which is fine, but that's not going to help get it into the policy process. And I want to illustrate that by just showing you, sharing with you some thoughts from Canada about different notions of evidence, which we tested in Britain and found to be almost exactly the same. In Canada, the Canadian Health Service Research Foundation did a fascinating interview study of policymakers in terms of what do they call evidence. They liked evidence to be colloquial, contextual, to be a narrative, to have a story, to have a line. What was the quality? Anything that seemed reasonable. They wanted it to be policy relevant, that seems fair enough. Timely, which they meant yesterday, and above all, they want a clear message. And I don't think they're unreasonable requests. I think anything that seems reasonable is a bit wrong, but they then went and did an interview study of people who do research and evaluation for government. And they used language such as we have to be scientific, context-free, generalizable, and the like. Everything has to be proven empirically. It has to be theoretically driven. That one really drives policymakers bananas, but it's true. How long does it take? As long as it takes, preferably with a large budget. I don't know, maybe you're different in Australia, but the way we train our researchers and evaluators in Britain, we seem to teach them all about how to establish the caveats and qualifications, but not to give the clear message. The last PhD I examined at Oxford was a very interesting 2.5 hours. I could have done without it, I tell you. But we spent 2.5 hours from this person's PhD thesis finding out what she hadn't found and what the problems were and this, that, and the other. I left that dissertation thinking, I haven't a clue what she found. What was worrying, she didn't have a clue what she'd found. She has a DPhil from Oxford University, and she's doing very well in the academic game. But we needed to take her good work, there was great work in it, but find out what the heck it was telling us. The caveats and qualifications took at least 110 pages, you know. That's not gonna help us get it into the policy-making process. Here's the really cheesy bit. That's a bridge. That's my bridge. I think that's good. Here's the advertisement. That's what my company does. We're trying to, along with other people, be that bridge between these two communities and to try and take the work that we do as evaluators, as researchers, try and match it with the needs and make accessible our work to policymakers. And I'll tell you in a second, in closing, one of the two things we do to do that. Before I do that, just let me tell you about the study we did there are 600 top civil servants in Britain. Top is defined as grade 5 and above, which is the senior management of the civil service. There's we interviewed just 60 of them in departments across Whitehall. This was an opportunistic sample. They in a very much a self-selected sample. We said, we want to come to your department and find out how you think. And we took whoever they put up. And we said, amongst a lot of questions, we asked them, where do you go for evidence, okay, for policy or practice? Well, I don't know if you can read that. First of all, well, my special advisors, that's why I have them. I guess you have special advisors in Australia. These tend to be politicos who come in with a minister. They've got him or her through a electoral process, and they're supposed to be the brains and the fixers for ministers. So special advisors was on everybody's top of the list. We then get this notion of experts, and I put experts in quotes because what counts as an expert is very dubious. But more serious than that, everybody in this room, your expertise is going to get dated very quickly. The longevity of expertise now isn't very long. We have so much in this knowledge economy. The stock and flow of knowledge is so great that anybody's expertise could be a matter of months or even weeks. I've been working with some people in oncology in Oxford. Oncology is a world hub for oncology research. And they're telling me that in some areas of cancer research, their expertise changes weekly, okay? Now, we found this out when we had two major agricultural crises in Britain. We had the BSE crisis and we had the foot and mouth crisis, where we relied on experts to get us through what should be done. And they were so behind the curve. They were so out of touch with the modern up-to-date evidence. They got it hopelessly wrong. In the case of foot and mouth, we're still paying an enormous amount for that. The last price tag I saw on it was £11 billion for the way they completely screwed up the advice to ministers and did exactly the wrong thing. So if you're going to have experts, make sure the experts have expertise. There is, incidentally, on the Cabinet Office website, there is something we put through after that, a guidance for experts and expertise in government. I'll go through these quickly. Professional associations, think tanks and opinion formers, lobbyists and pressure groups, the media. The number of senior civil servants who say, I like The Economist. Or one very senior civil servant said, I always phone, I won't tell you her name, but a very prominent British journalist. She always gets me the evidence I want and she can give me it over a phone, you know. I was gobsmacked. Does that translate? I just couldn't believe this. Here we have this, I've told you, this army of analysts we have to serve civil servants, and it's done by phoning up a very good journalist, I have to say. But she would probably phone us up and say, Phil, what evidence have you got? Then they talk about constituents, consumers, and users. My minister, our parliamentary members, they're the evidence. Whatever they think, that's the evidence that we have. It finished there. That was where they went for evidence. So ex-academic Davis turns up and says, what about academic research? It wasn't on their horizon. It wasn't anywhere near what they would go to. In fact, sometimes they were very rude about what we did. I'm using academic in the broad sense, including, you know, private sector consultants and evaluators. That's not the first place we go, and if we do, they have particular people they want to go to do it. So I found that my business, I was at the plankton level, and trying to get us up that energy chain, that food chain, to work with the sharks. And that's what I did for 6 years, and in fact I'm still trying to do, and I ask you to join my venture. There is a supply problem. This may be a peculiar British thing, but I bet it isn't. Often we've got something like this. I like this graphic, see? Researchers come in and the evaluators come in, but they don't get absorbed, okay? But they interact. What we did some analysis of a lot of people who work in evaluation and work for government, and they come so far and they yang on the brakes and say, I've got to keep my boundary distance. I understand that. I've done systems theory. I understand that. And it's for all sorts of reasons. It's about independence. It's also about whether you believe in knowledge for its own sake or knowledge for use. There's all sorts of good ideologies behind that. But when that happens, then you really do have a problem about doing my bridge work. If they don't want to, if they don't want to cross the bridge or even step on the bridge, you are going to have the problem. And that's very hard, because if you try to fix that, you're seen as somehow only getting the evidence from the people you want evidence from. So when we have framework agreements and things like that, it honestly and truly isn't just to get the evidence we want. It's to try and get people who want to cross the boundary distance and help to do that. So to conclude, how do we bridge this gap? Well, I've mentioned, first of all, the strategic planning. That is so high on my priorities. If that can be done, it's one thing we can do. It doesn't answer all problems, because you're still going to have your pragmatics and your contingencies, your everyday events. As we know as evaluators, it's a good idea to clarify what the issues are ahead of time with stakeholders, plural, not just the ones you think might give you what you want to know. I'm talking about the policy teams now. Theory of change, we've talked about that. This is crucial. You've got to get somebody in a policy team to own the evidence. I mean the evidence, not the policy, the evidence. I was amazed to find that what we often did in government was we procured research and evaluation just to get rid of a problem, okay? You'd say to some, if it was a difficult problem, you'd say, right, let's get somebody to do a 3-year project on it. By the time they come back, the problem will have gone. It's what we call kicking into the long grass theory, okay? And that's done an awful lot. It may be only a British phenomenon, but I bet it isn't. So what we now require is to have the permanent secretary level sign off on all those procurements, so that when the evidence comes back in, somebody owns it, somebody commissioned it, not a lowly researcher, they did the actual commissioning, but it actually has got an owner in the policy team. Ask answerable questions, you know this. I want to go to this one here, appropriate formats. We've learned from the Canadian government the only documents that should circulate in government are 1/3/25s. And in fact, in Britain, we use 1/3/15s. One is the take-home message for your minister, the key bullet points, the key graphic. Three is executive summary. And no document should be more than 25 pages or 15 pages in some of our departments, for the simple reason that nobody reads anything more than that in government. Unless they are Gordon Brown, our Prime Minister. Gordon does. Gordon's an avid reader, but I should get shot for that, wouldn't I? The very last thing is you've also got to incentivize people to use evidence. And in Britain, we're doing this with something called the Professional Skills for Government. This is now a competence framework that policymakers are working to. This is what you have to be able to do to get into the civil service, or you can get in to your likelihood to fulfill this competency. And to rise in the civil service, you've got to be able to do these things. It's a pretty standard kit of the things you'd find for most serious managers or decision makers in the private or the public sector. I won't read them out. You can see as well as I can. The bond, this should have flown in, but the animation's not working. The thing that we have got added to that is the ability to analyze and use evidence. It took some doing. They didn't want to do it. And we've also, and I haven't got time to go, and we build that into the appraisal system. All civil servants are appraised and rewarded annually. We have a bonus system in Britain for good work. But we've built that into the appraisal system. If you get a copy of these slides, these are the things that they have to do. You see evaluations in there somewhere, test for deliverability, ask challenging questions, use different analysts. It's an interesting set of things that they have to do. built into the reward system. And we've done the same for researchers and evaluators who work for government. And you can see what they are. Read them at your leisure. I'm hoping these are going to be available to you. The one we had most difficulty are the last two. Use interpersonal and other communicational skills. Communicate in a written and oral form clearly. Then I was responsible for administering this and for doing this, the professional development for this. The number of our researchers and analysts who said, Phil, I came into research and evaluation because I can't communicate. I haven't got any interpersonal skills. I'm a back office guy. Please don't make me go outside and talk to anybody. Which is understandable but unacceptable. It isn't just an extrovert's charter, but it is important. And if there are people like that, then you have to give it to somebody who does have those interpersonal skills, because that's how you get it to work in policy and practice. So my conclusions are, evaluation is essential for policy making. The strategic point I've mentioned, learn from what has been attempted elsewhere. Let's use the full range of evaluation methods and let's use them appropriately. Ideally, we like to test and pilot options with sufficient power before national rollout, and also to be prepared to adapt policy in the light of evidence. That's for the policymakers. They don't always like that one. My take-home message is this. Evidence-based policy making is no substitute for thinking-based policy. I put that in because I think many people don't think about the things we've thought about this week, and if they did, we'd probably have much better policy. Thank you very much.
Some questions. Thank you very much. That was very thought-provoking, plenty of issues for us to consider. In particular, I was quite reassured by your statement that professional associations have improved the quality of evaluation. So,
and are doing so. Yeah, it's an ongoing process. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, I won't talk anymore, but I think we have time for a couple of questions. We could encroach slightly into our tea break if there are lots of them. Okay. Could you go to the microphone and say who you are, please?
Hi, I'm Anne Chamberlain. I was just interested in what you were saying about the RCT that was commissioned that you did and came up with the sort of no impact outcome but was still adopted as policy. I'm just wondering, had you had a choice in the methodology you could have used for that evaluation, what methodology might that have been? And do you think it would have come up with the same answer and possibly prevented that thing being implemented?
Slight misunderstanding, or I didn't quite execute it correctly. That particular randomised control trial was not the one that I did. That was, and nor did I procure it, though I was on its advisory committee and it was done very well. They were very clever because they did do an RCT, but they had to, for all sorts of reasons, do some matching, controlled matches within that. It was to do with disability, and therefore, because of the heterogeneity we had, they did it very well. This was done by one of our premier research and evaluation organizations. There wasn't much wrong with it. Slight attrition problem in the second wave follow-up. No, the point was, it is so convincingly the case that this policy, as formulated, wasn't gonna work. It was simply, if it hits the political imperative and a stubborn minister who does it because they believe in it, it's going to happen. What worries me about that, it cost about £4 million. That was an expensive project to go ahead with the policy. And by the way, it's falling apart, as we predicted. It's called the incapacity benefit arrangements. So in that case, there was very little wrong with the evaluation. It was simply, to make my point, is sometimes you hit a brick wall. And when you do, that's when I think you really do need the interpersonal skills to try and move ministers around. But that's usually not our job.
Thanks, Philip, for a great presentation. I've got a question about the ideal schema that I think most Australian government departments are working towards, and I wanted your comment about whether you think we're going about it the right way. I think most government departments are basically adopting the process of, yes, developing strategic planning that is in line with government policy, and from strategic planning, developing what we call M&E frameworks, or monitoring and evaluation frameworks. And these frameworks sort of basically map out what data do we need to collect, what evaluations do we need to undertake, how are we going to learn, how do we disseminate that learning, and how do we assemble evidence to go back up to policy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've actually really mapped out a great process that most government departments are starting to work towards, which should solve a lot of these issues if the evidence that's actually assembled is then used.
Yeah.
And I just wanted your comments on that framework.
Well, my main comment would be about the ownership question is, I'm sure your framework's extremely well thought through and good. There's probably nothing with the framework. Some of you know that we developed a framework for qualitative research. If not, Google it. It's on the website. It's that the people who owned it were not in the policy teams, okay? So it's not just about the management of the administration of the evaluation, which is, in a sense, what we can do on our side. It's very much about getting that ownership of that and getting people to realize the importance. By the way, that's one of the things we would do under the analysis and use of evidence. Because often policy teams are saying, well, what do I have to do to use evidence? And you can say, well, look, we have this evaluation framework. And that's also about building the evaluation team in government, and sometimes actually with the contractors, into the policy-making process, okay? Just some small things, if we started co-locating them now, an example where we did it very badly, we used to, in DWP, our Department of Work and Pensions, we had the policy team in London and the analytical team were in Sheffield. It's 200 miles away. It's not surprising that they didn't use the evaluation framework. They just never came to work together. So I think if you can get that more integrated model, a strategic model, and also that notion of a policy person owning the evidence, then they would have some sort of incentivization. Then you have a chance of getting that really working in the policy-making process.
Okay, thanks. I think we can take one more question. I think, who was, Lorraine, were you first? Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Lorraine Larry, Renshaw, Hitchin and Associates, private consultant. But I have a foot in each camp, so I feel like I'm kind of the bridge between the two cultures, which is often linguistic as well as skills-based, etc. And I spend time in government departments,
yeah.
And I also spend half my week in private consultancy. And the interesting thing for me is that when I'm in the government department, I feel like I'm one of those journalists in Iraq who was embedded. And I'm really interested in your public sector development program, and how long has it been going? How long did it, you know, take to get up? Is there any evaluation of it yet?
Yeah.
And
how's
it working?
I think you mean the PSG, the Professional Skills for Government.
Yeah.
It was introduced in October 2005. So it's been going, this is the fourth spending round that it's, and appraisal round it's been operative. It's used very much for our recruitment and promotion of civil servants, which are changing, well, they're changing, I'm not in that world anymore. It took 2 years to really go from scratch to trying to work with some management consultants to actually build the competency framework and to have it refined and to do, so it must have started 2003. The evaluation is a great question because I was asked to supervise the evaluation of it and everything I put up got shot down because they said, oh, it's too complex, we don't want that, okay? Which was, you know, a bit of a snub. And they didn't want any notion of any control or comparator or any questions being asked, so I wasn't quite sure how we're gonna evaluate it. So to my knowledge, it hasn't been evaluated. Other than I suppose somebody is probably doing at the end of each spending round, because it's used in the appraisal system, they may be using some of that, which is not what I would call an evaluation. It's a missed opportunity. I'll tell you why it's important. I give talks around the world. A number of people countries are emulating it. And I'm very pleased to say that the analysis and use of evidence is getting built into competence frameworks. I was in Denmark last week. They've used this model, a couple of other Nordic countries. That's fine and dandy, but if it doesn't make any difference, I mean, how do we know if it works? I think it's brilliant, but it may just actually be a damp squib. I have no idea. And until they go and find that out, we just won't know.
Okay, thanks very much. Now, I think, we'll give you another clap, I think. How's that?
Thank you.
And I'm sure you won't mind talking to people over tea.
Not at all.
Susan has a quick housekeeping message for you.
Thanks, Phil, for that inspiring presentation. It was really very exciting and amusing. Yeah. In the program this afternoon, there's a closing plenary, and you'll notice that there's very little information about who's going to be on a panel discussion. So it's actually a mystery panel, and it's entitled The Last Word. Two of our keynote speakers are members of that panel, Phil Davies and Bill Trocum, but there are two other people that are going to be co-opted. One of them knows who that is, the other doesn't. So what we want to do is have have a session to bring different perspectives about the last 3 days of the conference as a summing up, and Jenny Neal will be chairing that session. There's also one concurrent session, 21A. I think we advise people on Monday, but for those who have only been here today, the last session, which is from the speaker was Jim Dance, unfortunately is unwell. And Bill Trocum has kindly agreed to take that session as sort of question and answers for his presentation on Monday, sorry, on Wednesday. So the other thing that I need to announce is that for people...
It may also be that it's going to be me raising questions to you about what you've gotten out of this so far, too. And I think it might be a nice precursor. I don't want it to just be you asking questions of me. I'd like it to be a dialogue.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's meant to be interactive. Yeah. And then last but not least, I feel as if I'm a bit of a nag, but there are evaluation forms in your satchels. But if you care to fill those out and give them to the registration desk by 2:30, you may win a book voucher for doing so. Of course, if you don't get round to doing it, we'll be happy to receive your evaluation forms later. I think there's a postal address for you to send them to. So that, anyway, so everyone can go to morning tea now.